When Buddhism came to China, it had been developing in India for some 600 years, and then it continued to develop in India for another 1,000 years or more. And then periodically, as the Indian developments showed themselves, they'd be transported to China, and the Chinese would receive all this different Buddhism. In India, because it was being born there, the Indians kind of knew all the different schools and how they related to each other and which sutras were the good ones and which ones were the, you know, ones you should not pay so much attention to. And they had all this, you know, understanding of the scene. It's like, you know, if here in America there's Christianity, which is all over, and we have some sense of the different denominations and schools and traditions of Christianity, and we can kind of keep them separate somewhat. But imagine that some, you know, the Amazon Indians who have never even heard of Christianity are suddenly importing, or we're exporting to them, Christianity. And we're not telling them about all the differences. We're just giving them all the Christian teachings from all the different traditions here in America all at once. So you guys sort it out. Well, that's how the Chinese were about receiving Indian Buddhism. And it took about 500 years for the Chinese to kind of sort through all these teachings of Indian Buddhism and try to make some sense of them. And they were quite amazing intellectual feats that the Chinese tried to do in understanding, systemizing this Buddhist tradition, all of it. And around the year 600 or 700 or so, 800, there was one of the greatest philosophers of Chinese Buddhism who took all this work of systematizing and trying to understand Buddhism and with the help of all the people who preceded him in his own study, he reduced all the teachings of Buddhism to one phrase. And that phrase was liberation beckons us within everything. Each and everything that exists in the core of that thing in some way or other, it's calling us, hey you, come, be liberated, be awake. So that's nice, so what does that mean? So I don't want to talk about exactly the meaning of that phrase, except that I think it's true in our hearts, that in the core of our hearts, there is something that beckons us, calls us, come, come. Come, be liberated. Come discover, come be at home in your own heart. Come discover the possibility of love, of compassion, of liberation, of generosity. Come discover the tremendous depth and joy and peace, which is the character, the nature of our hearts. And it's calling us, come. And many of us find ourselves in a centrifugal force away from our hearts. It's almost as if our hearts is a place where we're not naturally tending to go for many of us, but rather, and also society helps us not to go there. And it offers us lots of distractions, lots of goals and ambitions and things to acquire and do and be busy with. And we get involved very much kind of in the surface level of our lives. And it's very easy to lose touch with the internal life, the interior life, the life of the heart, the life of our deep spiritual psyche. And I think, you know, probably most spiritual traditions involve some kind of turning away from constantly being externally focused to discovering our capacity to internal life, the depth and the wealth that's available in our hearts, which beckon us, that call us, come here. Many of us don't listen to that calling, or have never stopped to hear it. But there's some turning away, and then discovering some internal aspect of our lives. One of the internal aspects of our lives I want to talk about today, one of the important aspects of the inner heart, of the spiritual heart, is love, is loving kindness. In the Buddhist tradition, love is usually divided into four different types. In Greek Christianity, Christian philosophy, I think, or Greek philosophy have, as I know, of three different types of love. There's eros, agape, and philia. And as far as I know in English, English is kind of, as far as I can tell, maybe you can, I've been corrected, it's kind of vocabulary poor when it comes to love. You know, some cultures have lots of words for love, and we have love. I guess we have friendship and things, different things, but in Buddhism, the four main words for kind of love are loving-kindness, or metta, compassion, karuna, sympathetic joy, or mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. And today I want to just kind of bring up the topic of loving-kindness, or metta, which is kind of the core experience of love that is pointed to in the spiritual life of Buddhists. I think it's in the nature of our heart to be loving. It's not something we have to kind of create or do or make happen. Those things that can happen sometimes that way, in a sense, but it's in kind of the nature of the heart itself, that inner life that calls us and wants to be expressed and to live through us, has a quality of love as part of it. And to a great extent, it's a spiritual life involves a shedding of the obstacles to letting that love shine and be part of who we are and be expressed in our lives. To shed and let go of those obstacles, to see those obstacles, understand them, and work with them, practice with them, so they're no longer obstacles. So our capacity for kindness, for friendliness, for love, for compassion, has a chance to kind of be an intimate and complete part of our life. Generally, when people have translated metta into English, they've chosen to translate it as loving kindness, kind of a compound word then. They've chosen not to translate it as love, but I saw recently a Thich Nhat Hanh preferred the word love. And he said, one of the reasons, he said, is that some words need to be healed. Some words, you know, are so worn down and broken and overused that rather than discarding them, we have to kind of reuse them in a way that brings them back to life. So he wanted to translate metta, a simple word, English, love. But when we add kindness to it, loving kindness, it suggests part of the quality of this metta, of this Buddhist idea of love. It's not passionate love, like eros. It has a kindness to it. It's a kind of softening, a gentleness, a warmth, a caringness for ourselves and for people around us. There's a lovely quote by Aldous Huxley, and he says, "Of all the worn, smudged, dog-eared words in our vocabulary, love is surely the grubbiest, smelliest, slimiest. Bawled from a million pulpits, lasciviously crooned through hundreds of millions of loudspeakers, it has become an outrage to good taste and decent feeling, an obscenity which one hesitates to pronounce. And yet, it has to be pronounced, for, after all, love is the last word." And then there's another thing. This is a Mullah Nasruddin, who's the wise fool of Sufism. Mullah Nasruddin decided to start a flower garden. He prepared the soil and planted the seeds of many beautiful flowers. But when they came up, his garden was filled not just with his chosen flowers, but also overrun by dandelions. He sought out advice from gardeners all over and tried every method known to get rid of them, but to no avail. Finally, he walked all the way to the capital to speak to the royal gardener at the sheikh's palace. The wise old man had counseled many gardeners before and suggested a variety of remedies to expel the dandelions, but Mullah had tried them all. They sat together in silence for some time, and finally the gardener looked at Nasruddin and said, "Well, then I suggest you learn to love them." How do we love that which is our weeds? I think it's a nature, again, of our heart to love all of life. The Chinese quote, "Awakening beckons us within everything." There's something in everything that partakes in awakening and love and a spiritual connection, of a sacred kind of life. And part of the practice of mindfulness is to begin appreciating the sacredness or the specialness or the liberated quality, the ennobling quality that's found in everything that we find, everything we encounter. In talking about this way, I think it's helpful to think of Buddhist practice as in part involving a shift of perspective. To begin looking at our life maybe from a new perspective than the usual one that we carry around with us. Because many of the usual perspectives we can carry around with us sometimes add to our suffering and cause problems. And one of the changes of perspective that Buddhism suggests is the one of loving kindness. To go around and see if you can discover how to live in a kind way, or to see the world through kind eyes, to see even your enemies through kind eyes, to meet everyone you encounter. What would it mean to be kind to the people you encounter? The famous quote by the Dalai Lama, where he says, "My religion is kindness." 25, 30 years ago, someone told me that, you know, the core expression of any religion at all was kindness. I would have just shrugged my shoulders and said, well, that's nice, but I'm going to go someplace where it's more profound. But to be kind. And then some of us had our mothers tell us, you need to be kind to people. And how many of us had our mothers tell us, you need to be kind to yourself? In the Buddhist tradition, the idea of loving kindness is supposed to be first started with oneself. To discover how to be kind towards oneself. How to have some friendliness towards ourselves. Friendliness to all our experience. Now you might say, you know, that's kind of sentimental. And that's what I did say when I first encountered this Buddhist teaching of loving kindness. But what I discovered for myself is that it's not a sentimental issue in the sense of something that gets applied on top of our life, a kind of a sentimental thinking or sweet, saccharine kind of thoughts about things. But it's really in the nature of our hearts itself, liberated, that when we're settled on our hearts, at home in ourselves, not in conflict with ourselves, not chasing after 10,000 things, not ambitious, not filled with resentment and hate and bitterness, that when all those things kind of have a chance to kind of settle away, it's in the nature of the heart itself to be kind, to be soft, to be friendly, to be gentle, to whatever arises, whatever goes on. And I emphasize this because I encounter many people who don't know this, and many people who have the attitude about themselves that they're not good enough to be at home with themselves, not good enough to love themselves, or they're not good enough, they don't deserve to be in a loving state or to rest and relax. They're not good enough as they are. There's always some other thing they have to acquire and do and become and hide from other people in certain ways. They're not good enough as they actually are. And to allow the love, the awakening that's beckoning us from within, to allow ourselves to be pulled to it or discover that internal life, we need to begin to get some sense that we are enough. That it's not a matter of doing more and acquiring more and attaining stuff or hiding part of who we are. In and of itself, as we are, we're enough, and we can discover, when we settle on that, we can discover this love. When the Chinese said that awakening or liberation beckons us within everything, he also meant that even within our obstacles, even within our self-hate and feelings of self-worth and doubt, our depressions and sadness, even in those things, in the core of them, if we have the eyes to see, we can feel this tenderness of awakening beckoning us. Buddhism over and over again focuses on how we can change the perspective on what's happening to us in our lives so we don't see ourselves a victim of it and see ourselves be burdened by it, but rather see the possibility, the ennobling possibility of liberation within anything. So love, loving kindness. The Buddha emphasized loving kindness a lot. And I read recently that in Christianity, certain parts of Christianity, I was reading a book by a Quaker, And he was using the Latin words, so I take maybe a kind of Catholic theology. He talked about two different movements in Christianity. One was called Contemptus Mundi, which means something like contempt for the world. And the other movement was Amor Mundi, love of the world. And he said both have to happen in a spiritual life. There has to be appreciation of both. And in Buddhism, the same thing. There's an emphasis in Buddhism on the necessity of some kind of turning away. Hopefully not the contempt has the quality of aversion to it, so Buddhists maybe don't want to say that. But some kind of turning away from that which always keeps us separate from the internal life, from that quiet, peaceful, loving, liberated place we can discover in our own hearts. But at the same time, there needs to also be the love of the world, the amor mundi. And the experience I've had, is that as we discover the inner life and give chance for that to live and be part of who we are and give space for that through meditation, through contemplative time, through all kinds of ways in which we allow that to grow and develop within us, that in a turn brings us with a greater sense of love for the world, or kindness for the world too. So it's kind of like two trains which are passing each other in the night. Withdrawal from the world, it's a very important part of spiritual life, is only half of it. And the other train is that which is the entry into the world with love and kindness. And both are happening can happen at the same time. Though some people emphasize one over the other at different times. So the Buddha also emphasized more or less the same thing. And the goal of Buddhist practice can be understood as a kind of turning away, complete turning away from any clinging to the world, any clinging to the world at all. But an important part of that path of attaining that and getting there is this quality of love, of loving the world, loving others. And this is encapsulated or expressed in one of the beautiful discourses of the Buddha called the Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness. And I spent part of today translating it. Because I kind of translated it before. I didn't really translate it before. I made my own version before, which is published in various places, and now I'm embarrassed that it's published. Even in our new book that we have out there. But I really went back and looked at the Pali today, the original, and redid it. So I'm going to read it for you. And this is the basis for the practice of loving kindness. So in Buddhism, we don't just leave it to chance or for loving kindness to bubble up. There's also a practice of developing this kindness within us. And that practice is said to have its origin in this discourse that the Buddha gave. Later in Buddhism, when Buddhist theologians kind of looked at this discourse, they divided it up into three sections. And they divided it according to the three trainings of sila, samadhi, panya. Of virtue, meditation practice, and wisdom. And so it's understood to be kind of a progression as you go through the text. So the first section of this, that part of virtue, describes the kind of virtues, the kind of qualities that are helpful to be, or you need to develop as part of a spiritual life. That spiritual life is not just only a matter of letting go of obstacles and just relaxing and hoping by relaxing enough that we'll live in a glorious spiritual, heaven. But it's also a matter of changing ourselves, changing our behavior, our attitude, qualities. And it's a slow process to develop things like patience and sincerity and different things. But to know about these things and slowly, slowly kind of take the steps we need to develop ourselves. So the sutta begins with this opening. To reach the state of peace, and that's just another way of stating to reach the ultimate aim of Buddhism, of Nibbana, of liberation, to reach the state of peace, those skilled in the good, and what's good, or skilled in the ultimate goal, they should be capable and upright, straightforward, easy to speak to. Are you like that? Gentle and not proud, contented, easily supported, with few duties, living lightly, with senses calmed, wise, not arrogant, without greed for supporters, and they shouldn't do the least thing that the wise would criticize. So if you can just do those things, you know, you think you have made. That's enough. So, and then the next section has to do with the development of meditation, more or less, a practice. So these people who want to reach the state of peace, who have these virtues and capacities, they should contemplate or wish in the following way. May all be happy and secure. May all beings be happy at heart. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, tiny or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere. Let no one through anger or aversion wish for others to suffer. As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so toward all beings should one cultivate a boundless heart. With loving kindness for the whole world should one cultivate a boundless heart, above, below, and all around, without obstruction, without hate, and without ill will. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, as long as one is alert, may one stay with this recollection. This is called a sublime abiding here and now. Then the last section is the wisdom part, or the cultivation of liberation. Whoever is virtuous, endowed with vision, not taken by views, and having overcome greed for sensual pleasure, will not be born again. Will not be born again in the cycles of suffering, moment by moment, day by day, lifetime by lifetime. As a mother would risk her own life to protect her child, her only child, so towards all beings should one cultivate a boundless heart. With loving kindness for the whole world should one cultivate a boundless heart. And one should have the following reflections or thoughts or wishes. May all be happy and secure. May all beings be happy at heart. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, large, medium or short, tiny or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. So this is an expression of certainly the Buddha's love, his emphasis that he put on it, that certainly I think came out of his own understanding that loving kindness and kindness is an essential part of the spiritual path, at least he was talking about. It's not incidental, it's not a byproduct, you know, it's not just a byproduct, it's not extra credit, it's not, you know, for the sentimental, and if you're really, you know, tough and strong and direct in your spiritual life, then you'll, you know, you don't need it. There's a beautiful story, kind of a little bit sad story maybe, one of the most famous Japanese Zen masters of recent centuries named Hakuin. And he was known to be a very tough Zen master. And his lineage became one of the most important lineages eventually of modern Japanese Rinzai Zen. And near the end of his life, when I don't know why he got to meet an old man, he stopped teaching. And he said that he'd become too kind to teach. And you know, to be a good teacher, you have to be really firm and you know, I guess. So I failed. But so it's a beautiful story because I think that, you know, in his years of development, his kindness kind of comes with the practice, with time. Some of the kindness comes from being humbled enough, because when you start going into the inner life, it's often quite humbling what we encounter. And some of it comes from just the nature of the heart itself, that this kindness, this love, this gentleness, this warmth, just right there. And part of the Hakuin story, I think, is sad, because maybe it's, you know, maybe he was actually getting more mature in his spiritual life, he had more to teach and offer people as he became kinder, rather than being this fierce, you know, Rinzai master. So, love. When I was, I feel very lucky that when I was 20 or so, I discovered something that since that time has been invaluable for me about love. And that is, my summer when I was about 20, I fell in love with a couple of people. And my their availability to me was kind of distant. Actually, they were across, at some point they became across an ocean. So they were far away. So I had the whole summer to think about these two people that I'd fallen in love with, and without them being available, and without any knowledge whether it was going to be reciprocated. And in the course of the summer, I discovered what I call the joy of unrequited love. And this is one of the great secrets of, you know, one of the great, you know, keys of happy living, I think. What I discovered was that there was a difference between my desire, my lust and desires relationship to these people, and the sense of delight and warmth and happiness that I came up within me when I thought about them. And until that time, I'd kind of maybe entangle those two. I thought, you know, if I love someone, then I have to have them in some way or other. And I saw that desire and love were actually two different things. And I found that I could rest with the love, with the pure love, with the simple love, with the kind of love which doesn't have to have any desire as part of it. Love doesn't require desire at all. And that has served me so well as I've gone through my life. Because you know, there are times when I find it's been really easy to fall in love. And I just kind of rest in that joy and delight and pleasure of that. And I don't feel any need sometimes to try to act on it or do anything about it or have desires connected to it. Just really, it's really a lovely thing to look at someone and feel just delight and appreciation and warmth and tingling and kind of softening and, you know, about, you know, someone else. And in fact, there are times, and they've grown over the years, but it certainly doesn't stay, it's not constant, it kind of goes up and down depending how deep I am in my practice and how connected and all that, where I seem to fall in love with everyone. And it just, I look, I see people and I just feel just delight and happiness and joy. And other times when I don't have that, and I look at someone and it's kind of, I hope they don't sit next to me. But I know that when I have that kind of attitude, I'm not really connected to my inner life. I'm not settled on myself. I'm not at home with myself. And when I'm really at home or settled or quiet, then I'm much more likely to appreciate people that I meet. So to separate out the desire from love, from what we need to get, you know, or the empty holes, the wounds that we have that we often try to fill, to separate out the psychological needs we have, the desires we have, from the very simple qualities of love, I think makes life a lot easier. One of the also great discoveries that I had through my Buddhist practice is that it's possible to have a state of love, to be in love in a sense, or feel love, feel great love. And it doesn't require an object at all. It doesn't require any person, even love for oneself or for, you know, anything. It just seems to be the quality or the nature of a heart which has been opened or liberated or present, is that it just loves. It's like a furnace, which is, you know, someone lit the furnace and it's on, blasting out all this heat. And you say, you know, but no one's in the building. The furnace doesn't care. Maybe there's not even any building. It's just the furnace is on and it's just blasting out all this heat. It's kind of like the heart just kind of blasts, you know. It just kind of opens. There's a softening. Blessing is probably not the right word, because the usual, it's a very peaceful feeling, we're kind of open, gentle, kind, soft. The word for metta is sometimes etymologically connected to the word softening or gentleness. It's connected to the word for friendship, being friendly. And one of the things that I think we need to learn to love, one of the things that's helpful to learn to love, is everything within us that makes it difficult to love. And for some of us, perhaps at the beginning of practice, is learning to have some kindness at least, or friendliness, some kind of acceptance of all the obstacles to it. So rather than setting up love as a goal, as an ideal that we have to measure ourselves by or try to attain, a lot of what we do is study what gets in the way of it. And that itself is one of the surest ways of discovering it. And I have to keep relearning this, I'm embarrassed to say. So one of the most difficult parts of my practice in the last 15 years is going to meetings. I had no idea when I started Buddhist practice that Buddhists are expected to go to a lot of meetings. At least Buddhist teacher types. And the Buddha allowed for 13... You know, mostly Buddhism is the middle way, and he rejected asceticism back in ancient India, all ascetic practices, standing on your foot for 32 years on one foot or whatever, all these things they had back in ancient India. But he allowed 13 ascetic practices. And not that dramatic, you know, not that ascetical, but he allowed 13 a monk could voluntarily take on. In America, the 14th ascetic practices is meetings. And I'm not very good at meetings. And it's actually been at times quite painful for me, the way I participate in it and my feelings that come up and all this stuff. So I had to go to a meeting yesterday. Big meeting. And I said, okay. I said, what I'm going to do is, I'm not going to say much. I'm just going to lay back, sit back and be relaxed. I'm going to do loving kindness. And whoever speaks, I'm just going to do loving kindness towards them. And, you know, I don't have to say anything at all because, you know, I don't have to get my opinion across. You know, I'll just be detached, you know, at peace, not wanting anything. It's a little embarrassing, right? I should know better. But, you know, kind of that was my attitude. So I showed up to the meeting, all kind of geared up. And there was a wonderful facilitator for the meeting, a very wise man. And one of the first things he said at the meeting was, these are the desired outcomes of the meeting. Before we proceed, we want to go through the room, make sure everyone here agrees that those are desired outcomes. And if anybody has any objections, speak now. So suddenly, I had to either agree, which I could be quiet, right? But if I didn't agree, then I had to say something. And I said, I wanted not to say anything at all. So right there at the beginning of the meeting, I had to say, well, actually... I feel differently. And what I found by the end of the meeting was that it wasn't a matter of me trying to be kind and loving and whatever. It had to be, it was really, as the meeting proceeded, it wasn't so much about focusing on those people out there and trying to be loving towards them. It was really staying with myself and staying with what was going on inside of me, and being very honest about that over and over and over again, and really seeing what was going on with me, and being honest and expressing myself as sincerely as I could, apologizing when I needed to apologize. And then, by the end of the meeting, I was feeling all this love for everyone. I was feeling all this kindness and warmth, and it was really delightful. And it wasn't just me, it was also the facilitator that helped make it happen that way. So it's not a matter so much a matter of deciding you're going to be loving. I don't think it's that way. As it is when it's available to you to recognize it, to give ourselves the opportunity to let that inner life come forth. If we never give a chance for the inner life to be there, it's not going to come forth. So give ourselves the opportunity to feel it if it's there. If it is available, then nurture it and develop it. If it's not there and not available, then and you like the idea of discovering love and coming from a kind place, then it's a matter of studying the obstacles to it. What's really going on for you? And seeing, can you be kind to that? Can you be kind to your anger and your hate and your bitterness? Because without kindness to those also, I think it doesn't really work, the whole practice. Can you discover, what can you be kind to? What can you be friendly to? What can you bring some kind of softening to or love to within your, with yourself? What is your relationship to love? What is your thoughts about love? Do you keep it at arm's distance? Are you afraid of it? Do you hold on to it as a, you know, ideal, as a kind of lifesaver? Are you desperate for it? Is it a nice idea for someone else? What have you learned about love in your life? What have you learned that you want to keep? And what have you learned so far that maybe it would be good to unlearn about love? How valuable is it for you, the experience of love? If you've been told that you can love without an object, that love is inherent in the nature of who you are, does that have any real value for you? Is that important for you? Is that something you'd like to orient your life around a little bit? Or is it more interesting to go to work and make a lot of money and be busy with projects? Who have you met in your life that's been loving? Who have you met that feels sincerely and genuinely kind of kind, a kind people, a kind person? Have you allowed the kindness and love of other people to resonate, to register within your own heart, to influence who you are? The practice that most complements mindfulness practice, the practice that we do here, the insight practice, is the practice of loving kindness. The practice of being kind, or wanting to be kind, the practice of wanting happiness for ourselves and happiness for others. And now it's time to end, but I'd encourage all of you to, if you haven't had some contact with the Buddhist practice of loving kindness and metta, that you do so, learn more about it. In that book, my book that's available, you can just have it for free, it's out there in the hallway. There's a couple of chapters on loving kindness, and there are other Buddhist books that talk about it quite extensively. Thich Nhat Hanh has a whole book now called Love. Sharon Salzberg has a book. And as we go along here in this new center, I hope that loving kindness becomes a very rooted practice for what we do here. And at some point we will have classes and retreats here on the practice of loving kindness. So may all of you be happy and safe and healthy and
one of the obvious people in the world that has been a spokesperson for living, loving kindness is the Dalai Lama. And in today's paper, it was reported that he has a growth in his stomach and he's ill. And I found myself really moved by that and found myself in spontaneous prayer all day today and seeing, appreciating what a place in the life holds. Place in the world that you also just wanted to put out in the name of the community to send prayer in this direction. Appreciate what he's done for us all.
Yeah, so the Dalai Lama is sick with some kind of stomach problem. And he's been, yes?
I have heard that supposedly it turned out to be just an infection, so it's not.
But the beautiful thing, you know, the two people we've evoked this evening is we evoked the Dalai Lama, which for many of us is kind of one of the great examples of love and kindness and liberation and really inspires many of us. And the other person we've evoked is the person who's going to be executed tonight. And part of the ideal in Buddhism is to have an equal dosage of love and kindness to both people. and not just simply choose a Dalai Lama and exclude those people who, you know, we don't like or feel are our enemies or whatever, but to actually find the capacity within us to bring kindness and love to the full range of who human beings are. We have the capacity, I believe, within each of us to love everyone, even our enemies. And perhaps we learn to love our enemies first by loving our friends. So, regardless of how well or poorly the Dalai Lama is doing, I wish him well and lots of happiness. So thank you very much for this evening, and I will see you in a month.